MediaFree.tv Podcast Network.
How come everybody's saying that you're not upset, that you're not crying, that you show no caring of where Taylor
because
is at
I'm
all?
Because I'm not sitting here crying every 2 seconds because I have to stay composed to talk to detectives.
When I listen to that first jail call, there's some big red flags that jump out at you. This girl just doesn't seem to be genuinely interested in the fact that her daughter is missing.
A two-year-old goes missing, the West Memphis 3, and one of the four crime writers on. It's The Blotter Presents, Episode 5. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, everybody. I'm the desk sergeant up in here, Sarah D. Bunting, and I am joined today by Toby Ball of Crime Writers On. Hello, Toby.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. Less okay is our most wanted topic for the week. Casey Anthony, An American Murder Mystery, which is an investigation discovery presentation. Listeners, if you wish to quit now based on that information, feel free. Let me ask you, Toby, had you watched the JonBenet version of this franchise?
The only one, that's not the one that had...
Clementi?
Yeah.
That was the case of... There was like a whole... like bolus of JonBenet programming, and the investigation discovery version is, like X, An American Murder Mystery. And so they had a JonBenet version and now they've moved on to Casey Anthony. So I take it you did not enjoy the JonBenet product one way or the other.
Sadly, I missed it.
It wasn't great, but it was better than what you would expect from most investigation discovery programming. This, I felt, was a little bit of a step back for a channel that is trying to, I think, get less trashy. What did you think of, first of all, how much of Casey Anthony have you watched and what did you think of it?
I watched the whole first episode and I found it a little problematic, quite honestly, for a bunch of different reasons. The first thing was they seemed it was just made like I was surprised. Like at the end, I was like, wow, I've forgotten that she'd gotten convicted. And then I looked it up and of course she got off. And the sort of tone of the episode is so sure that she's guilty. That it was a little surprising to me that they didn't take a more, nuanced look at it. And maybe that comes in episodes 2 and 3. I think it was hard to watch the first episode, if that was basically all you knew, without coming away with the idea that she was clearly guilty and was probably in jail right then.
Right. I also thought it was problematic, not least because the title is misleading. This is not, according to the show's own lights, this isn't a mystery. Casey Anthony, according to the show, is history's greatest monster. And you're right, they really don't deviate from that, despite the fact that they do have exclusive interviews with her parents. And sometimes those are accidentally revealing. Why don't we take a listen to clip one for an example of that?
Tons of friends and lots of little boyfriends. Casey and I were inseparable. I mean, we shopped together, we did crafts together, we went on walks. We were very close.
At the age of...
That's just a weird clip to me. Like, first of all, I don't think that Casey Anthony has been helped in her life by what this clip implies, which is that she has the friend mom.
Right.
But it's also like doing crafts and taking walks together is closeness. Like that. It was just such a strange thing to, is such a strange phrasing, or a strange way to describe parental closeness, particularly from someone who I believe was the one who called the cops on her daughter in the first place because right. She'd stolen the car. So, yeah, that struck me as very bizarre.
Yeah, the relationship with the parents, particularly the mom, you know, the mom is, it doesn't take much of a leap for the mom to think that she's guilty. And I think she sort of operates from that vantage point during the show. And then certainly afterwards, when they're taping, both the parents identify themselves as Kaylee's grandparents and not Casey's parents, which was strange.
Yeah, I think there's definitely an opportunity here for documentaries that are addressing this case to look at what our response to this case as a society may have said about our attitude towards women and mothers and all sorts of weird complexes that we have about how people are, quote, supposed to behave once they have children. I don't have children, but you see this in true crime coverage all the time. This extremely harsh, like corrosive judgment of how bereaved parents are or are not behaving. And that seems to have been where the indictment of Casey Anthony, like aside from any actual evidence in the case and in the courtroom, came in. So let's listen to clip two real quick and then talk about that a little more.
They're going to pin this on me.
Casey.
Mom.
What?
No.
I don't know what your involvement is, sweetheart. You're not telling me where she's at.
Because I don't know where she's at. Are you kidding me?
Whose fault is you sitting in the jail? You're blaming me that you're sitting in the jail?
Not
blame yourself?
Fault.
What do you mean it's not your fault, sweetheart?
I don't find Casey Anthony particularly sympathetic, but it does seem to me that she knew from the jump what the narrative was going to be about her. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. The whole thing, like, I just didn't know much about the case. So there was just so many strange things that she did, like taking them to what Universal Studios, where she didn't actually work, and kind of like bluffing it out until there was no more room to bluff and then admitting it. But she
right.
No, that wasn't going to go well. So, yeah, she seemed pretty savvy about that, about how she was going to be seen. And certainly if she had any access to television during the time she was in jail, just based on what you see in the show, she must have been pretty aware that the public perception was negative. And I assume that her case was picked up on by like headline news. I mean, they have that Jane Velez Mitchell. Is that her name?
Yes.
Who on there.
And who has the unfortunate distinction of sounding, at least to me, exactly like Jeanine Pirro, who that's a no thanks talking head to me, at least.
Yeah. Well, she seemed like, I haven't seen much of her outside of this, but she seems to have that sort of, you know, extreme confidence in her insight, despite, you know, maybe having a lack of full information. So she seemed to take
very
like,
gently put
a lot of glee in describing Casey Anthony as the most hated woman in America. That seemed to be something that she enjoyed. So yeah, that was just another thing that kind of came through, was that you have these people, like after Casey Anthony gets bailed out and she's staying at her family's place, and these people are just showing up and, you know, provoking fights with her dad and ringing the doorbell and screaming at the house. And, you know, like you were saying before, like as a comment on sort of, you know, some part of our culture, this idea that you can watch TV and know enough about something to feel that strongly that you're going to go and start harassing people, like trying to mess with their lives because you think that, you know, Casey Anthony's clearly guilty. It's strange. You know,
I think you're absolutely right that people felt empowered by, and now I'm kind of talking out of my ass, but I do feel like this is a case that Nancy Grace definitely used as a stepping stone to higher visibility for herself. And I, you know, that viewers would feel empowered by Nancy Grace's, you know, daily indictments of Casey Anthony and her family to physically take their asses to their home. And I don't know what they thought they were going to do. Try to wreak some kind of Florida street justice. I don't understand the thinking there. Before we get further into that, let me just play a clip that illustrates what you were talking about the confidence of this commentator about Casey Anthony's psychology and reactions.
Hi, sweetie. We're not doing well, Kate.
Someone just said that Kaylee was dead this morning.
Surprise, surprise.
What mother says surprise, surprise about the disappearance of her own daughter? The reaction was so inappropriate that it just was chilling.
Well, I don't know. I'd found that one of the least chilling things that we heard Casey Anthony saying. I don't know about you.
Right. I mean, I think it goes back to what you're talking about sort of expectations for the way that people will talk about things or behave, that I think, you know, in situations of extreme pressure, you know, heightened emotional pitch, you know, also dealing with, you know, the loss of your child, it seems unfair to expect people to fit within like this pretty, small rubric of what you're allowed to do, supposedly.
Yeah, this sort of like sackcloth and ashes range of acceptable responses.
Right.
What it put me in mind of, actually, when she's sort of like, surprise, surprise, I interpreted that as like, her guilt or innocence aside, that she already knows what people are saying and how she's viewed by law enforcement and by the, you know, by the public. And she's like, shocker, that's the response. And it kind of reminded me of that, the big, like, gotcha moment in The Jinx,
right,
where he says, killed them all, of course. And I was kind of like, I think he's just talking to himself. Like, I'm not saying he didn't kill them all, of course, because I'm pretty sure he did. But I don't think that proves anything. I think everything else proves.
They made a lot out of that on The Jinx, and I thought it was pretty ambiguous.
So, as a overview of the case, based on what you've seen so far, do you think that this is worthwhile for people who, like me and apparently like you, didn't really know or remember much about the disappearance of Casey Anthony and want to get caught up?
I guess. I mean, I feel like I got a lot more knowledge than I did, but the way it's put together, I just found kind of off-putting. And part of it may just be sort of pet peeves. And some of it, I wasn't sure if they were being like sort of subtly like making comments about things, such as, so they do a lot of like recreations where they kind of fuzz everything. So you can't, the people look enough like, their true life counterparts that you
right.
can kind of imagine that it's them. But for whatever reason, they were constantly focusing on the woman who was playing Casey Anthony. The camera was on her breasts all the time.
Yeah.
It was bizarre. And so I was like,
and they're not transparent either. About when it's a reenactment and when, and sometimes it seems like it's a reenactment like on the visual track, but then the audio track is genuine, but they don't really say. And then you have a couple of commentators that are literally on every single show that this network produces, like, bless their hearts. It's a Living, Diane Diamond, and that guy from the National Enquirer. But I mean, yeah, it's not the classiest, like, most professional build And if you do feel like the case should be reexamined, I don't think this is an objective look at the case and what happened, and actually trying to figure out what happened to Kaylee between when she disappeared and when her body was found in the woods. Like, I don't think it does that well.
No, they seem pretty clear about what they think.
Yeah. Do you disagree though? Not that it matters.
That she killed her kid?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I always, it seems again, like you're kind of getting the prosecution case in this.
Right.
So if she was found not guilty, like there must have been something, because you're watching this and there's, it seemed unbelievable to me when I looked and saw that she was found not guilty. Like, there's clearly stuff, there's more to the story, and maybe that's what comes in episodes 2 and 3, but there was no way you could watch that show and say, it seems more likely that somebody else did it.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, the case itself, the show is not so entertaining that I wasn't like just reading the Wikipedia entry on the case
mm-hmm.
while it was on. And it is this sort of Occam's razor thing where it's a little bit tough to come up with a scenario in which she didn't do it, or at least know what happened. But on the other hand, she was found not guilty. I mean, I think they did find her guilty of like obstructing a police investigation or whatever it was.
Right.
And she did a little time behind that, but the actual death of her daughter, they couldn't make that stick. And I think a better use of one's time might actually be reading the Wikipedia entry, because it is faster. I've seen parts of episode 2 and it's just kind of like the same pearl clutching about her father's suicide attempt, the allegations from the defense that he touched her inappropriately when she was a kid. Casey, that is,
right.
Kaylee. It's pretty much what you'd expect. And these three-night events on Investigation Discovery do tend to have diminishing returns. So, and in fact, there is an SVU episode based on this that wound up, based on this case that wound up being this like PSA about anti-vaxxers, starring Hilary Duff. It's season 10, episode 19, and that's a mere 42 minutes, and it's on Hulu. So, folks, save yourselves a couple hours and check that out instead.
So they combine Casey Anthony and anti-vaxxers into one show?
Yeah. I think somehow it turned out that it was still the Casey and Kaylee Anthony case, but then the cause of death was that she had like mumps or some other vaccinatable disease. And then she and her whole family like freaked out and put the Kaylee equivalent in a cooler, which is like Law and Order's favorite place to put dead tiny children. So yeah, SVU, it's a lot.
Wow.
Anything else to add before we move on to a significantly more competent true crime work product?
The only thing I was trying to figure out what was going on with is when they place the detectives in these different places, to have their conversations. So like John Allen seemed to be in a barn of some sort, just sitting on a chair in the middle of a barn. And then there's another guy who seemed like he was in like a pretty nice hotel. And Eric Edwards was sort of introed in a shooting range. It also, I wasn't quite clear on what was going on there, but it was definitely kind of amusing.
Yeah, this is definitely a chance for me to plug something that I had on my blog, The Blotter, which is at the-blotter.com, which is the true crime show bingo card. And you can check off a bunch of squares with Casey Anthony and American Murder Mystery, like the focus pull on the upside down crime scene tape, out of focus reenactments, cops doing cop-like things that they wouldn't actually be doing for the benefit of the cameras, like being in a shooting range or filling out paperwork. So yeah, a lot of that. You'll have bingo in no time. All right, friends, moving on to a true crime classic. In my opinion, it's the cold case section. Toby, you have brought us today's cold case topic. Would you like to introduce it and tell us a little bit about why you wanted to revisit this property?
Sure. This is a documentary that was made by HBO called Paradise Lost. It's about the murders of three second grade boys in 1993 in West Memphis, Arkansas. Three high school age boys were arrested, Jesse Miskelly Jr., Jason Baldwin, and Damian Eccles. And in 1994, they were tried. HBO, I'm not sure how they sort of latched onto this case.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Yeah, but they showed up. They show up with their cameras, and they follow sort of there's two narratives kind of going on, and one is the story of the defendants, and essentially what happens is that Jesse Miskelly Jr. I think he has an IQ of 72, and he basically gets bamboozled by the police and kind of tells a story that's clearly untrue, but puts Jason Baldwin and Damian Eccles, you know, at the scene and killing those kids. So you kind of follow their side of the trial, and then you also spend time with the victims' families, who, at least to me, are not as sympathetic as you would imagine the families of child victims would be.
No, at least in this initial film, they're not. This, of course, is the story of the West Memphis Three, who since have been freed. Spoiler on an Alford plea. I was obsessed with this case and still am. I watched their first press conference, like live streamed it and followed it on Twitter when it happened. And I was at the premiere of Paradise Lost 3 and they were there and I got to see them. And it was like this miracle of justice. It was fantastic. But this film is still rage making, like that you have the ridiculous satanic panic, literal witch hunt that's happening involving these three kids. So that's one strand. You have the coerced confession strand of a developmentally delayed defendant or suspect. And then you have the fact that these three children were murdered and we still don't really know who did it. I assume you're not of the school that insists that the three who were arrested were responsible.
No, it seems pretty clear that they were not.
Yeah. But the satanic panic thing, I don't know. Like, this was not something that was confined to the South. Like, this kind of hysteria, for lack of a better term, like there were cases like this in Texas, in New Jersey, in California, it was all over the country. But like, I still can't believe that this kind of thing would happen and that the whole communities would get swept up in it. Actually, why don't we listen to clip number 5, which is one of the victims' moms talking about whether she believes that Satanists are responsible.
Do you feel that the people that did this were worshiping
Satan? Yes, I did.
Why?
Just look at the freaks. I mean, just look at them. They look like punks.
Well, let me ask you this. Did you watch this when it first came out, this film?
I didn't. I watched it, several years after. Like, I'd heard about it, and then I watched it, it was probably 6 or 7 years ago, and then I watched it again just a couple nights ago.
Right. I didn't watch it right when it came out. It was a couple years after, but I believe I was obligated to rent it at Blockbuster. Kids, ask your parents. But there was a sense at the time that he was the real bad guy. And rewatching it now, and of course, having watched the second and third films in which he comes around to sort of advocating for the West Memphis Three's innocence and saying that the real killers have not been caught. There was a sense like 20, 25 years ago that he was the bad actor in this situation. And I'm not sure where that came from, because watching it now, there's nobody like this guy. Like, he looks like he's out of a restoration woodcut, lessons about avoiding the devil. But yeah, I don't like watching it again. I don't know where we would have gotten the sense that he necessarily had anything to do with it. So,
well, they do, you know, they show a thing about how he had whipped his stepson with a belt that day. And they also make a point of the fact that he had a brain tumor. And, you know, I didn't know if the idea was that that would somehow affect his, you know, ability to control himself or whatever. But yeah, I mean, the first time I saw it, I think I felt more, I was looking for a scene that I thought I'd seen the first time, and maybe I just saw it in a preview for one of the different ones, where he's walking and he kind of looks over his shoulder in this very menacing fashion. And I didn't see it this time. But he does, you know, again, the filmmaker makes choices about what parts of interviews and what actions you cut into the film. But, you know, they didn't do him any favors, certainly. And he's, you know, I wouldn't say that he was involved, but the way he reacts to things really kind of speaks to sort of frontier justice, I guess.
Yeah. And there's also a distinctly performative aspect to his responses to the camera that, you know, there is that specifically like Baptist / Pentecostal, you know, eye for an eye flavor to it. And he does have certain phrasings that are compelling. Like, he's a born performer, this guy, but in the context of what's going on, that could be a little suspicious, I guess. Actually, let's listen to clip 6 where, you know, just buyers being buyers.
I hope y'all really believe in your master, the Satan, the sleuth foot, devil himself, because he's not going to help you. He's going to laugh at you, mock at you, and torture you. He didn't need your help. The devil's got all the devils he needs. The good Lord said Lucifer and a third of the angels were cast from heaven. He didn't need them, but he took their mind and he manipulated them. And they prayed to Satan and they prayed to the devil. And they had their satanic worship services out here. And they had all types of wild homosexual orgies, I've been told. Crazy things.
He's been told by...
Right.
Who now?
Crazy things.
Crazy things. And yet... underlying all of this, at least to this English major, is like this fairly impressive, almost Miltonian reading of Lucifer's ejection from heaven, that, you know, he's these two things at one time. He's suspicious and close-minded, but then also quite well-read.
Right. Have you ever seen the movie Marjo?
Maybe. Remind
me. It's a documentary about, I'm not going to remember his last name, but this guy who was like a child preacher, and his parents were both preachers. And I guess it was made during the 70s, and it follows him around as he does this tent revival in this sort of rock star evangelical type way. But what's interesting about it is that it's just absolutely a performance. Like he totally rejects all the stuff that he's talking about. And he's sort of become this sort of hippie guy. But this is how he makes money.
Huh.
Is that he goes out there and puts on his show. And it's about a lot of different. It's a great movie. But part of it is about, you know, when you are brought up in an environment where that's kind of the lingo, you know, that's what you're used to being around, that he can just kind of break into it, you know.
Right.
It's just part of his culture.
Well, then, yeah, you know, and conversely, when you hear some of what this one preacher was talking about, what Damien Eccles had told him about Wiccanism and not believing and such and so, like, then I'm like, this just sounds like a teenager who does not want to go to church when church is 3 hours. Like, I'm not sure you can take a 16 or 17 year old at his word when he's trying to shock the head of his congregation so that he doesn't have to go back there. Maybe right. That's just me at that age.
It's interesting. And I don't know if it would have been the same when it first came out. But looking at it now, like you take a look at John Mark Byers and you take a look at Damien Eccles, and like, who do you think is more of an outsider? Like Damien Eccles doesn't seem much different than like a whole bunch of kids I've run into in the course of my kids growing up. Whereas I've never seen anybody like John Mark Byers, but in this, you know, at least in this little community, like he's respected. He sings at his church, you know, people look to him. So it there was sort of this strange flipping of who's on the in group and who's on the out group. You know, at least to my sort of New England in 2017 existence.
Yeah, but no, I think that was true contemporaneously as well, that for a lot of the country, the idea that kids wearing black t-shirts meant anything but what it meant, like that there right. was a larger conspiracy of evil implied by listening to Metallica, to this like Jersey kid who was in the parking lot smoking with the Heshers was ridiculous. Like that was just being a kid where I was from, but
that was around the time with Tipper Gore and the, the Judas Priest suicide and the, you know, back
class action lawsuits against Black Sabbath and all that.
Yeah.
All that kind of thing. So, oh God. Yeah. Oh, Tipper. Well, that didn't turn out so well for her. It's interesting that you picked this too, because you see in both this and the Casey Anthony case that the cases are being tried almost in the community, like separately from, but tied into what's happening in the courtroom, and that a lot of the information that's out there is just incorrect and bad and maybe being generated by non-cult, non-experts. But let's take a listen in clip 7 to what the rumor mill gets up to.
Prison's not a safe place.
Jesse, sweetie, I'm gonna mail him a skirt.
One down, two to go. Hopefully the same thing will happen to the next two and we'll get the same verdict.
They found my son's testicles in a jar of alcohol in Damien Eccles' house with his fingerprints on the jar. Now, how do you dispute that?
Some idiot started a rumor saying that they found children's sexual parts under my bed or in my house. And there was no body parts in my house or... Just, I think maybe the police had something to do with it, just because however, if they can make us look bad in front of the public, then people are going to kind of have their minds made up before anything ever comes out.
What's striking to me about that clip is how, like, stricken Damien Echols seems to be, just sort of talking about what did happen to these kids. And kind of thinking about what it must have been like for them and for their parents while still also defending himself. But Toby, you called for the beginning portion of that clip. Why did you want us to listen to that bit?
Well, I just thought it was indicative of sort of the viewpoint of the victims' families in you know, they were looking for vengeance. They weren't just looking for a conviction or, you know, closure or whatever. I mean, she basically wants Jesse to be raped in prison. So that was sort of, you know, it's an interesting way of sort of, it's not even portraying, but the way the filmmakers were sort of showing that as being largely the face of the victims' families. They also show aspects of grief as well, but I think it's sort of a 50-50 thing. The HBO films really portrays two aspects of their sort of dealing with their children being murdered, and it sort of falls more on the vengeance side, the way they put it together, and they certainly show them experiencing grief. But I don't know. I found all this sort of, you know, a little jaw dropping, I guess, that they would, feel this strongly, but more so that they'd be willing to say it in front of a rolling movie camera.
Yeah. Do you think there was maybe a little more, naivete? 20, 25 years ago? Like, do you think that just when it was filmed, people were a little less accustomed to just that in their lives pre-internet? I don't know the answer I'm asking.
Yeah, that could be. And it also could just be that, you know, why wouldn't anybody feel the same way? Like, why would somebody judge that as being strange? You know, of course you want to get that kind of revenge.
Yeah. Do you... On that tip, how do you feel about how the parents and their desire for vengeance and the community as a whole were treated in terms of being, you mentioned like that they would maybe be considered the outsiders today, but did you feel that the film was like condescending or dismissive of them at all? Or do you think it gave them a pretty fair hearing as to who they are and where they're coming from?
That's a good question. You know, I guess they don't come across as sympathetically as they might. I think they're shown, except for the parents who are sort of a different matter, but the other members of the community, I think, are shown as being, sort of very small-minded, and very sort of narrow, sort of religious, but in a very, very narrow way. So I don't know what the truth was, but the representatives they pick are a little bit from central casting, I think.
Yeah, and certainly law enforcement and the prosecution witnesses are not necessarily the most impressive exemplars of a, you know, thorough and well-researched theory of the case. Why don't we listen to our last clip, clip 8.
Anything wrong with wearing black in and of itself? No. Anything wrong with the heavy metal stuff in and of itself? No. The Book of Shadows, anything wrong with that in and of itself? No. But when you look at it together, and you begin to see inside Damien Echols, You see inside that person, and you look inside there, and there's not a soul in there.
My client is a teenager, and we certainly didn't hide that fact from you. And the fact that my client did some writings, take these back. Go back and read them. Go read all these. But this, in and of itself, is no evidence of murder. And even if you add in all the other things, quote, trappings of occultism, according to Dr. Griffiths, that has nothing to do with this case whatsoever.
Yeah, we didn't have a clip of the so-called cult expert who I believe they established got his master's degree in cultic studies by mail.
And he took no classes.
Yeah, but he just like read some books and felt ways about cults. Yeah. But the clip we just heard was from closing arguments in Eccles and Baldwin's trial. That was the prosecutor and Eccles's defense attorney. And you could really feel the attorney's frustration that he's like, I can't believe I have to refute a theory of the case that is so ridiculous and irrelevant. But I do, because this is taking place where it's taking place. That was as frustrating to watch this time as it was 20 years ago, even with everything said and done. I mean, did your jaw drop all over again, like listening to this cult expert on the stand?
The cult expert. You know, the only thing that's changed since the first time I saw it is that I've read more about how people who seem a little bit more legit are just as completely like bite mark experts, for instance, are just there's no science there, you know?
Right.
It's like, this seems like an extreme case of some guy just talking out his ass, when in fact there are less extreme cases with similar consequences that happen, you know, fairly frequently. The other thing that, you know, the idea that part of your closing argument is that the defendant has no soul is just bizarre.
Yeah, that doesn't seem like a fact and evidence to me.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say. Objection, you know, facts not an evidence. And that you can make that determination based on, you know, the music he listens to, a book he read, and, you know, his preferred hue of clothing.
Yeah. And yet, you know, satanic panic cases still were happening up to 10 years ago. So it's really, I don't know. And coerced confessions still happen. Defendants with certain intellectual challenges are not given any like leeway. This kind of thing, this case after many, many years had, I guess, what you would call a good outcome, but they're still happening. But with all of that said, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just, you know, I think the good outcome is largely the product of having a documentary about it and getting a bunch of high profile people to speak out about it, and money being made available to the defendants.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Whereas I think if this hadn't happened, if the documentary hadn't been made, you know, I don't see any reason why those guys wouldn't still be in jail.
And it took 3 documentaries, many fundraisers. I had that bumper sticker on my car for years. I mean, it really was the highest profile case of its kind. So it's hard to separate case from film, especially here, but as film, I think it really holds up. I think they do a really good job given how insane the circumstances are. I think it's it's an activist documentary, but I don't really have a problem with those. I still think it's a classic in the genre. Would you agree?
I do, definitely. And, you know, watching it pretty soon after watching the Casey Anthony thing, it seems like almost the opposite of it. Like, despite the fact that it's activist, it's not just one-sided. I think it deals fairly, but pretty fairly with the other side as well. But it seems pretty clear that they're not guilty, and it's mostly a product of who they are rather than what they did.
Yeah. I would say that, and I didn't remember this because it's been a while since I'd watched it, but the film is quite compassionate towards this community, towards the parents' outsize, you know, revenge fantasies, and even towards this somewhat overmatched law enforcement community while still thinking that the results are unjust. So, yeah, I can't imagine that most of our listeners have not seen Paradise Lost, but if you haven't, it's on HBO Go. Please check it out. And Toby, thank you for forcing me to watch it again. It had been a while, and I enjoy is never the verb that we use with this stuff, but it's really a well-made film and it holds up.
Absolutely.
So before I get into the booking sheet for the next episode, Toby, do you have anything that you'd like to plug for our listeners?
Sure. Like as you said at the opening, I am on the podcast Crime Writers On. We're a weekly podcast about crime and pop culture. I also have 3 books. Just Google Toby Ball on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and you can find them.
Been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.